I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order and let the record reflect that the time is currently 3 o'clock on Monday, April 2nd, 2018. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Representative Grin, Representative Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Foster. Before we start, just a reminder, if folks could mute their cell phones. Today we'll have three bills before us. Those are HB 268, Opioid Prescription Information, HB 221, Workforce and Education Related Statistic Program, and HB 400, which is Fees for Fire Prevention Measures. So the first bill up for us is HB 268, which is Opioid Prescription by Representative Guerra. And the committee does have a CS before them. Representative Guerra, if you could please come to the table, put yourself on the record, and if you could first explain to the committee the differences between the CS version E that is before them and version N that has been passed out of that was passed out of Health and Social Services. And so with that, if you and your aide, Ms. Claire Gross, could put yourselves on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Les Guerra, District 20.
And Claire Gross, aide to Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically the difference between the proposed committee substitute and the original bill is we've transferred requirements that are consistent with the Center for Disease Control's guidelines on informing patients about the dangers of opioid addiction and opioid prescriptions, and also the CDC's guidelines on informing patients about reasonable alternatives to those potentially dangerous drugs. We've moved those requirements very much into each of the prescribing boards' rules and regulations, and instead said the boards shall adopt their own regulations, giving the boards leeway in determining which patients they should provide this information to, which exceptions to craft, and what the penalties should be. We've moved everything into sort of each board gets to adopt these regulations on their own, and we give them roughly 9 months until next February to adopt regulations. So that's really the difference. The difference moves from us prescribing rules to us asking the boards to adopt their own rules that basically are consistent with the CDC guidelines. I could walk you through each one of those changes, but that's really what the difference is between the CS and the original bill.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. So we do have a CS before us. I do want to also note that we're joined by Representative Pruitt. And so maybe, Representative Seaton, I would entertain a motion to adopt the CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move a committee substitute for House Bill 268, version 30LS1081/E be adopted as the House Finance Committee as its working draft.
Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, CS for HB 268, version 30-LS1081/E is before the committee as its working draft. And so with that, Representative Guerra, if you'd like to proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A number of members of the legislature were here for, I believe it was House Bill 159. That was the governor's larger opioid bill. And we learned a lot in that bill. Apart from the bill's provisions, we learned how addictive these drugs are. We learned that roughly 80% of the people who use heroin today started out on a painkilling drug, usually an opioid painkilling drug. We learned that the longer you were on an opioid prescription, the more likely it was that you would become addicted. And you'll see in the PowerPoint, we learned that the death rate in Alaska from prescribed opioid overdoses is about twice the national level, and the national level is alarming. What we also learned through our research is that while prescribing professionals are coming along in recognizing these dangers, there's still a gap between that exists where prescribers are not always informed enough or telling their patients about the dangers of opioid prescriptions. And you'll see that that's recognized all the way up to the Center for Disease Control. A number of states have adopted or are adopting bills very much like this one. Right now, roughly 91 people die a day from opioid overdoses. We know that they're dangerous, and we especially know that given the bill hearings that we had in this committee a couple years ago. As I said, for the last year that we have information, the death rate from opioid prescription overdoses in Alaska is double the national average, and heroin-associated deaths are 50% higher than the national average. And there is a link between opioid addiction and heroin use, as I mentioned. This is a chart that we saw 2 years ago. Basically, the longer you're on an opioid prescription, the more likely it is you're going to become addicted. And the bottom point is what we also saw a few years ago, which is, again, that roughly 80% of those who end up using and abusing heroin started out on pain-killing drugs, usually opioids, hydrocodone, things like that. So HB 268 is a patient information bill. If we inform patients about the dangers of opioids, the potential addictive qualities of opioids, and that there might be alternatives the patient might prefer to a more dangerous drug, if we inform patients, they'll be able to protect themselves against addiction. They'll be able to protect their families. If they know, they'll be able to look out for their children and their other family members. It's basically a patient information bill. The professions that are able to prescribe in Alaska include dentists, doctors, podiatrists, osteopaths, advanced nurse practitioners, and optometrists. And so this version of House Bill 268 basically puts the regulations in each of these boards' hands. And we require, and this is language from the bill, we require the boards to adopt regulations that would require the advice to patients using oral and written information before prescribing an opioid of the potential dangers of opioid addiction and alternatives to the opioid prescription the provider considers reasonable. We're not going to get inside and interfere with the provider-patient relationship. If a provider doesn't think that an alternative is reasonable, they don't have to go through every alternative that might exist out there. We're trying to make the bill as simple as possible for providers so that it's useful. We also want to give boards leeway to make exceptions to this requirement. So the requirement will generally apply to outpatients. If a board wants to apply their regulations to certain inpatients, that's fine. They can exempt classes of patients. For example, some people say that cancer patients do not need this information. I think that's debatable. I personally think that they do, but we'll leave that to the boards to decide. A lot of cancer patients are prescribed opioid painkillers because really it's the only painkiller that makes sense in a particular circumstance. You might decide not to provide a warning in that case. Obviously, hospice care, there are people in hospice care who will use an opioid, and I think a board might determine that providing this information to a hospice patient might not make sense. People who are going through opioid treatment, the drug that you use in opioid treatment is an opioid, so there's not a whole lot of sense in requiring that information to be provided in those cases. There are going to be times where a doctor, for good cause or because they're busy with another emergency, is going to not do everything possible and is going to possibly violate a time or two here or there, and we want to give the boards leeway to not punish somebody in those cases. We also want to make things easier for providers, and the department is very amenable to this. We want the department to post a printable document on their website that can be used by providers to give to patients so that they don't have to come up with their own document on the dangers and potential dangers of opioids. And that information the department will, and they generally have on their website right now, but we don't want to make a doctor's office come up with their own document if they don't want to, and so they could just download what's on the department's website. The department's happy to do that. The no civil liability for violating the bill, we didn't want to interfere with the doctor-patient relationship by sort of threatening lawsuits, but the way the bill is written right now, this now becomes a board requirement, and so there's no civil liability. So that provision is effectively still in the bill. And like I said, we want to give the boards the ability to allow practitioners leeway to make honest mistakes. You don't want to punish a prescriber who makes an honest mistake, who has to run to an emergency and therefore didn't give a patient information that they otherwise would have. The idea for this comes from the National Centers for Disease Control. They recommend, they don't make this mandatory on the national level, but they recommend that all providers discuss the risks, the benefits, and the alternatives to opioid medication with their patients. And they've made this recommendation because we know that on across the country, some providers, many providers are providing this information, but many are not. The CDC guidelines are actually much more comprehensive than what we're asking boards to adopt. The boards can adopt more comprehensive rules if they wish. We are just trying to get them to adopt at least minimums through this bill. So I think most of you already know this, but why do we want patients to be informed? And I think the most sort of eloquent statement came from the CDC's director, who said, "We know of no other medication routinely used for a non-fatal condition that kills patients so frequently." That's what opioids do. Then the bottom bubble on the right is the other reason for this bill, where the CDC has found that many patients lack information about opioids and identified concerns that some clinicians miss opportunities to effectively communicate about safety. This is not being done, unfortunately, by all providers in a uniform way. More and more providers are doing this as information gets out. House Bill 159 requires that providers get training on the dangers of opioids by this June, Claire? It's by very close to the end of the session, yeah. Assuming the session ends when the session should end. Mid this year, all prescribing professionals should have had training as mandated by the former opioid bill. So they understand the dangers of opioids, the dangers of addiction, the dangers of death. So this bill is sort of timely in that it melds very well with the training that is being provided to prescribers. It's only recently that the CDC adopted these guidelines, and the CDC's head calls this a culture shift for patients and for doctors, but also other providers. As we know, other providers do prescriptions as well. And as CDC Director Tom Frieden said, starting a patient on opiates is a momentous decision, and it should only be done if the patient and doctor have a full understanding of the substantial risks involved. That's why the CDC has adopted these guidelines. So people have said, what is your proof that prescribers are not providing this information already? You know, we don't have the money to document exactly every provider that is providing the information, every provider that is not, but we know a lot are not. The CDC knows that, and that's why they've issued these guidelines. And other states have followed the same approach that this bill follows. Essentially, basically, we have to give patients information because we want to make sure all providers are providing the information. We know that they're not right now. Time magazine quoted folks at the CDC, and that article was stated, "This problem of overprescribing opioids and, according to other research, failing to warn patients about the risks of dependence and overdose isn't unique to emergency doctors. It goes on to other doctors as well." And actually what we found by speaking to Dr. Ann Zink, an emergency doctor, well-respected emergency physician up at the MATSU, is frankly the emergency physicians are getting on board because they see the effects like firsthand from opioid addiction and opioid overdoses. So actually the emergency doctors are getting it quite quickly, and they understand the need to provide patients with this information. Bill, much like the one that we're proposing here, passed in Michigan. There's one pending in Maine, but all because of the information we have that the medical community is still catching up to the evidence on this, which is opioids are dangerous, they're addictive, and they can kill you, and they do kill you. So, Mr. Chair, I wanted to go through this sort of quickly because I have some more information to provide the committee. We've made progress on this bill. The Dental Society They've testified and said a bill like this is necessary, and they don't object to it. They're one of the prescribing authorities. Optometrists have their own board. We haven't heard from them yet. And nurse practitioners have their own board. Physicians and their board governs doctors and osteopaths who are doctors. They initially objected to this bill. Then they directed us to the sort of decades-old rule that that patients be respected by making sure they prescribers get informed consent for any treatment from a physician. And so I think those were the two early sort of expressions that they opposed the bill. But most recently, they've advised us they're considering regulations to comply with the CDC guidelines. They haven't adopted the regulations. We'd like to keep the bill out there to until they do adopt those regulations. But their regulations won't affect dentists, which would still be governed by this bill, or optometrists, who would still be governed by this bill, or advanced nurse practitioners, who would still be governed by this bill. Though I will admit that when the physicians and osteopaths, when they come on board, that'll solve over 90% of the problem that we're facing. But we think it's a matter of life and death. The committee members know that, and we've tried to address it in as non-intrusive a way as possible for medical practitioners, by giving them as much leeway to decide where an exception to the rule should apply, and by giving them as much help as possible by asking the department to post information on their website so that physicians don't have to come up from scratch or invent a handout from scratch. They can if they want, but we don't want to make them do that. So with that, I'm happy to take questions. I apologize if I sped through too quickly. I just didn't want to take a lot of the committee's time.
I think you did perfect, Representative Guerra. Thank you. I just want to let folks know, Also available for questions are Claire Radford, Bill Drafter from Ledge Legal, and Chief Medical Officer from the Department of Health, Dr. Jay Butler, and Eliza Muse, Substance Misuse Prevention Specialist. And so with that, do we have any questions for Representative Guerra before we move on to the three invited testifiers that we have, Representative Seaton and then Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at page 4 of your slides, and I was trying to figure out, this is showing the one-year probability is basically double the three-year probability, so that people that are continuing to use, does that mean they no longer use after only half as many are continuing to use at 3 years?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the one-year probability is maintaining and overusing opioids for 1 year, and the people who overuse for 3 years, that's the lower line. So people who continue consistently using the opioid drug for 3 years, that's a smaller number of people. A number of people who use through that 1 year don't continue for 3 years. So that's the difference. These are straight from the CDC, these graphs. They were actually in the governor's bill packet. We stole them from the governor's bill packet from 2016.
I think you also want to note that we were joined by Representative Guttenberg at the start. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you kind of answered somewhat of the board's, and I don't know how frequently each board meets, but has each board had the opportunity to actually have it at their board meeting, discuss it, and then be able to give feedback on what they currently do and how this may impact each one of them?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I can't speak for the boards. Our understanding was the medical board was not happy with our bill at first, but they now seem to be coming along and they now seem to be considering the CDC guidelines. We don't know what the regulations will look like if they're in fact adopted, and we don't know if they'll be adopted. The other boards, we have no information from the Department of Commerce that they've adopted any regulations on this issue at all. And so our information is they've adopted no regulations on these rules.
Follow up? But I guess my question is, have they had a chance to even have the bill, because it's kind of you know, changed as it's gone along. And so during the legislative session, has it ever been on their agendas to discuss? Because it sounds like you might be talking to different board members, but have they actually had it on their agenda so that it could be a full discussion, not just by one or two people? Because I'd like to know, you know, why they would or would not be in favor of it.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we have brought this straight to the Department of Commerce, the person who works with boards. The only board we've heard back from is the medical board. We've heard from practitioners, who some of whom are supportive and some of whom say you're interfering with the patient-doctor relationship, and that we're already providing this information. And I guess my answer would be, for those who are already providing this information, this bill doesn't impact you. It impacts those who are not providing this information. Are they aware of this bill? They should be. This bill was pre-filed. They should be aware that the original version of the bill would have required these exact providers to provide this information. It's now been relaxed in this version to say you can adopt your own regulations, but the bill has already always regulated every single one of these prescribing boards.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And so I'm trying to figure out, too, how's this going to be policed? I mean, you have in here that the prescription the provider considers reasonable, so I'm not sure what, and it repeats itself. So I'm looking on page 3 of the e-draft where number 11 starting on line 13 goes from 13 to 21. So I'm not sure how you define concerns reasonable. The board may determine which classes of patients may be reasonably exempted. Again, I guess everybody's not going to have the same rules. And then is there any definition of what good cause is that's on line 19?
Through the chair, good cause is something we ran by Ledge Legal. It's a commonly understood term, and a board can come up with additional exemptions that they determine are reasonable. These are the things that I was talking to the committee about before. You probably don't want to regulate these discussions with hospice patients. You might not want to regulate, require these discussions with certain cancer patients where this is maybe an opioid, maybe the only prescription. You don't want to require these discussions with people going through opioid addiction treatment where the treatment is an opioid. You may only want to do this for outpatients as opposed to people in nursing homes. And these are all reasonable calls that a board can make. And so we want to leave that leeway with the boards. The big impact will be for the bulk of patients, it will be providing this information to outpatients. We wanted to give the boards leeway. We wanted to give the boards leeway by saying what a provider feels is a reasonable alternative. So that we're interfering with the patient-doctor or patient-provider relationship as little as possible. I think it's fine if a provider has a strong belief that there's an alternative out there, but it just makes no sense for a patient. Somebody with a low pain threshold and, you know, maybe Tylenol might work for one person, it's not going to work for another person. But the term reasonable is also one of those terms that is very well defined in the law.
Okay, follow up?
Follow up.
Well, I'm not an attorney, so I don't know what either one, I mean, the actual definition is. But how many providers at this point do not give any kind of this information? I mean, is it 10%? Is it 20? And how are you able to quantify that?
Through the chair, I would say if any providers are not providing the information, that's too many. The CDC decided that enough providers were not providing the information that they adopted national guidelines, and a number of states have addressed that as well. And the head of the CDC is very clear that the evidence is that providers are not routinely providing this information. Many are, and many are not.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
Just a question to you. I don't know who the invited testimony is, but on that list, is it any of the board chairs of the groups that we're talking about in this bill?
So unfortunately, none of the three invited testifiers are available. Looks like we have a few people online. Representative Guerra, are you familiar with whether or not
they've been invited?
Through the chair, we did not reach out, and I guess I would say this is a policy call for us. I know we've had a number of practitioners contact us with support, or these are the classes of opposition. We already do it. If you're already doing it, you're not going to be burdened by this legislation. I don't do it. Well, then you should. And I don't have enough information to give people a warning about the dangers of opioids. We've heard that from some practitioners, and our response is you should. So I guess I'm certainly willing to listen to board input, and we have from the medical board. And that's why we rewrote this bill, to say that if a board has decided to become proactive and adopt its own regulations, that's good enough. So they've had their impact on this bill, but I guess I'm not very interested in a response that we don't want to be regulated. And that's been very much of a handful of practitioners have come to us and said, we don't want to be regulated. People are dying from opioid overdoses. And for those practitioners, those very few practitioners who say, I just don't have enough time to learn about this stuff, we want you to learn about it. And I don't have enough information to provide a patient with information, we want you to provide that information. And that's where legislation comes in, and that's where we as policymakers get to say, you know, these are our constituents too, and we want patients armed with information.
And Mr. Chairman?
And Representative Wilson,
and I agree it's a policy call. But I think we should send out an invitation to the boards, because how do I make a policy call for groups of people who may already be doing it in a fashion that they feel comfortable with? Because the boards are usually pretty regulatory on themselves. But just like I was asked if I should talk to any agency with any of my decreases and stuff, and when I kind of said they'll just tell me the same thing, this kind of falls into the same category. But I would like to reach out and invite them to testify when we hear this bill again. But I'm willing to listen to whoever we have today. Thank you.
Just FYI, we also have a Gail Berndt with Executive Administrative Board of Nursing, DCED, and also a Patricia Owen, Alaska Public Health Association.
Are those supports or are those the actual boards? Those sound like more support people from the state.
Yeah. Representative Guerra, are you familiar?
Through the chair, we have sat down with the head of the Department of Commerce's board function, the deputy director that works with the boards, about this bill. I have every belief that they've reached out to the various boards, but we also have a letter sitting on my laptop or my computer right now asking boards to comment. And you know, you can hold the bill here until the end of session so it dies, and I hope you wouldn't do that. We hope we'll get the response by the time this bill moves over to the other body. I do have a belief that having proactive legislation like this will maybe get boards to take a look at the CDC guidelines and decide whether or not they want to comply with them on a mandatory basis rather than a per-provider voluntary basis.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
I'm just a minority member. I'm not looking to hold anything. But before I can make a policy call, I really would like to understand what the boards require now, whether they require anything. And if not, I mean, they're the ones with the medical degree. I am not, and I don't have a problem, making a policy call. But I don't want to be duplicating something they're already doing or processes they're already. And I think a simple invitation, because now the bill's before us, is the least that we can do to make sure that we aren't interfering and that they're not maybe already doing something better than what we're even proposing here. I just think that's part of a duty when we're asking for a policy change. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions of the committee for Representative Guerra, Representative Seaton?
Thank you. On page 11 of your PowerPoint. I'm not quite sure where it is in the bill, but no civil liability for violating bill requirements. Is that on providers, or is that on the boards for not doing it?
Through the chair, in the haste of switching this PowerPoint over to the new version, the former bill was a requirement imposed by law. by statute, and we were very clear in that version of the bill to say we're not adding any new civil liability. But now we're just asking the boards to adopt regulations. So that part is unnecessary at this point. The board will decide what the punishment is, and the board's going to be required to adopt rules, and we've given the boards broad leeway in deciding when something should be sanctionable, when it shouldn't be sanctionable, but it'll just be by the board. And so we're not attaching any civil liability. It would probably be redundant to add the no civil liability version to this version of the bill, provision to this version of the bill. It's the boards that will be deciding whether or not to sanction somebody.
Follow up?
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure, since this was here, that it was not a actual term that was going to prevent the boards from having sanctions on the providers who they're supposed to supervise. And so that was a purpose for that question. I guess the other thing I just wanted to relate is that I know that at least in the last several years, and the only data that I've been able to be provided was that from the Medicare Part D. And Medicare Part D prescriptions, we have large areas of the state where, including my area, the Kenai Peninsula, where 9.5% of all prescriptions for seniors under Part D Medicare were for opioids. And that's more than twice the national average. And we've seen it, other states having this huge problem of the same thing. I'm kind of in alignment that we have this problem that at least some doctors that are treating wide swaths of seniors across the entire, and we have that information by zip code from the national database at Medicare. And so I'm very concerned that the problem is much bigger than we mostly see, because a lot of those come through mail on prescriptions, not illegal at all, but when we have almost 10% of all senior prescriptions being for opioids and people following doctor's orders and taking them as directed, we lead to exactly the problem that you had stated earlier about the CDC. I agree that we need to do this, and I think it's a much better action to have the boards that are, run by and associated with the different professions, fully aware of that, and passing regulations instead of doing a one size fits all across all of the different professions. So I appreciate that mechanism, the change in the CS. So thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Guerra, I don't doubt for a minute that the therapeutic and the behavioral health doctors recognize that this is a huge epidemic that's on their shoulders now for treatment. I don't think that a significant part of the medical community recognizes it as their problem. And, I've read enough that there are, like you mentioned, some doctors recognize that and are already given that information. Some don't, right? And I've been in enough medical conference where they're trying to solve the problem, and it's always the other guy. It's not them, costs, whatever it is. What has been your feedback? And I imagine that if you go to an AMA board meeting or a specialty doctor, it's like, hey, this isn't us. They think it's the junkie or the somebody else. But where do they think this stuff comes from? A significant part of it is through prescribing and overprescribing and people just getting addicted on what they're taking on long term. But what is the negative feedback you've got from the medical community? Not just, we haven't talked about it, but the actual ramifications or understanding that, you know, the doctors, this lays right in their laps. Do they have any understanding of that?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I think a lot of doctors and prescribers do, but I think if we think that that the medical profession is different than our legislative profession or the legal profession or any other profession out there where some people do better work than other people, I think the reality is in every profession some people do stronger work than other people do. I will tell you, I am so impressed with Dr. Zink from Matsu Regional Hospital, the emergency room physician, who said, you know, I mean, we know about this stuff firsthand, and we get it, but her recommendation was that we adopt a bill, but maybe sunset it. And we thought, well, the way we address that is we'll just leave it to the boards and not have an independent legal requirement. But I think we can't generalize about prescribers. You asked the types of responses. I think I've given all the negative ones that I could think of are, we don't want to be regulated, we know better than you do, which they tend to. But if you know better than we do and you're not providing a patient with this information, then you don't know better than we do at this point. And I'm sorry, I don't agree with that comment from that small group of providers who have said that to us. And for those who don't have have said that they don't have the information to know what to say to a patient, they will within a month or two, because that's really the deadline for prescribers to do the opioid addiction training required by HB 159 passed 2 years ago. So for those prescribers who don't have the information, they should have it by now or will have it within a month or two.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
Well, my concern is in those boards where there are, you know, they don't have the partisan lines that we have. They have a whole nother set of their own lines that at this point that they haven't come up with a policy where they haven't sat down and said, this is a problem. We're all different as well. But the costs on this to society and to our healthcare structure is devastating. And the fact that they have not come up with, when you have the CDC, you have endless reports on this problem, the fact that they haven't come up with a policy, that they're waiting for nothing or for the pressure from the legislature to do something for me, is by itself problematic.
Do we have any further questions of the committee? Seeing none, we'll go over to public testimony. And as I mentioned, the invited testifiers are not available, but we will open it up to public testimony on HB 268. Is there anybody in the room who would like to testify? Is there anybody online who would like to testify? And we don't have anyone, so we will go ahead and close public testimony on HB 268. And folks who might want to submit written testimony can do so by emailing us at housefinance@akleg.gov. Again, housefinance@akleg.gov. And so with that, is there any other discussion by the committee? Seeing none, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the effective dates, it's just a little confusing to me because on page 7, starting on line 14, it says basically the boards will shall implement regulations on or before February 1st, 2019. And then in section 8, the following sentences, it's saying, oh, I guess that's A and B, take effect immediately. And if you could just discuss with us a little bit whether there's any contradiction in there and whether you think that gives the, if this would pass and be signed by the governor, that regulations implemented by February 1st, 2019 would be is a reasonable date for the duration to implement those regulations.
Through the chair, the effective date issue is, it'll take me a second to answer.
And Mr. Chairman, when we bring the bill back up, that would be fine if there were, want to look at that further and then address the question at that time of does that give enough time for the board to actually implement the regulations that would be done under the bill. So I just wanted to make sure that everybody, or that I had raised that question so that there was time to discuss it and look at that.
Through the chair, just briefly.
Representative Gere.
Thank you. Yeah. No, thank you for raising that. And I'll bring back a more detailed answer. The 50,000 foot level answer is the department can put the information up on the website for doctors to grab. Basically, that's an immediate thing. We want to give the boards the time to do public notice and comment and maybe retract regulations and redo them. So that's why the regulations don't have to be in effect until February 1st, 2019. But the remaining questions that you had, I'll have an answer for the next hearing.
Thank you. And we'll go ahead and set aside HB 268. If folks have amendments, if they could get them over to Jane Pearson in my office, we'll shoot for 5 p.m. on Wednesday, April 4th. So with that, our next bill up today is HB 221, which is Workforce and Education-Related Statistic Program by Representative Drummond. And here to present the bill is both Representative Drummond and her aide, Mr. George Ascott. We also have Stephanie Butler, Director of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education here. And so, Representative Drummond, if you could introduce yourself, and I understand you might have some introductory remarks. So if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chairman. Thank you to the Finance Committee co-chairs, members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Harriet Drummond, Chair of the House Education Committee. I represent Spinard and Midtown Anchorage in the House. With me are my aide, George Ascott, and Stephanie Butler, Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education. I am honored to sponsor House Bill 221 as part of ongoing efforts in the legislature to take a detailed look at ways to improve how we as a state spend money on education and job training in Alaska. House Bill 221 will help the legislature to best allocate and utilize increasingly scarce resources available for education and workforce training by clarifying the authority of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education, or ACPE, to receive and analyze existing data from state entities through a statewide workforce and education-related statistics program. HB 221 also changes the law to permit the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to share unemployment insurance data for the purposes of the statistics program, as permitted in federal regulation and contingent upon a written agreement with ACPE. HB 221 is not at all about tracking or collecting data on individuals. It is about statistical outcomes. It's about taking a bird's eye view of spending results based on analyzing and aggregating data that we already have to create outcome statistics. HB 221 will help policymakers in the following ways. It provides a more secure method to transport data between agencies. It lowers costs to access and analyze information. It combines multiple processes into a highly secure, automated, and cost-effective process. It provides greater access to longitudinal information. It reduces the time and cost required to perform program outcomes reporting. Alaska spends more than $2 billion annually on education and workforce training, but we don't know which programs produce trained Alaskans who are more likely to remain in Alaska and contribute to our economy. What is the return we receive on these huge investments? HB 221 will allow for more meaningful assessment of program outcomes across the K-12 postsecondary programs and into the workforce, and it has no additional cost to the state. At this time, if it pleases the committee, my aide, George Ascott, will provide a brief sectional analysis of the bill.
Great. Mr. Ascott, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you. Hello and good afternoon, Chair Seaton and Foster and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is George Ascott, staff to Harriet Drummond. and I am here to provide a brief sectional analysis to describe what actual changes will occur to state law under HB 221. If you take a look at the bill, you will notice it has five sections. The first section of the bill is mostly existing statute and goes on till the beginning of the third page. Under existing law, the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education is allowed to adopt regulations to administer financial aid programs, institutional authorization functions, and interstate compacts, which includes the collection and confidentiality of data. HB 221 creates authority for the Commission to adopt additional regulations. These regulations are regulations relating to the collection and analysis of K through 12 data as approved by the Department of Education and Early Development under its current authority to collect that information, and regulations for a new purpose, which is administering a statewide workforce and education-related statistics program. The next section, Section 2, which begins on page 3, line 6, is all new statutory language. Currently, the law allows the Commission to collect data and share it with the governor, the legislature, and other state and federal agencies, but they don't have clear authority to maintain and analyze the data. Section 2 of HB 221 changes the law by adding three new subsections so that subsection B, the Commission can maintain a database for the purposes of administering a statewide workforce and education-related statistics program and enter into cooperative agreements regarding education and employment with other agencies. Subsection C is added, in which the Commission is required to remove personally identifiable information before it is entered into the database, and it may not provide personally identifiable information to the federal government. And a subsection D is added, which just defines a unit record as information that pertains to an individual. Then on section C, starting on page 3, line 22, currently, the Department of Labor and Workforce Development is not allowed to share data regarding unemployment insurance with other agencies. This section changes the law to permit the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to share such data for the purposes of the statewide workforce and education-related statistics program as permitted in federal regulation and contingent upon a written agreement with the ACPE. Then we have another section 4 beginning on page 4, line 5. This just makes it clear that data obtained before the effective date of the bill can also be obtained, and section 5 is just the immediate effective date. With that, I will turn the microphone over to Stephanie Butler, Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education. Thank you, Representatives Seaton and Foster, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Butler. If you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you, Mr. Ascott. For the record, this is Stephanie Butler, Executive Director at ACPE. With me in the audience is Carrie Thomas, our Operations Director. Some very brief background. ACPE is charged with providing Alaska citizens with tools and resources to access and be successful in college and career training. Some of the ways we accomplish that are by managing the Alaska Performance Scholarship and the Alaska Education Grant, the APS and AEG programs, and offering low-cost student loans, among other activities. But the question we ask is, are these the most effective ways to increase access and success? In this time of severely constrained resources, are we using the state's increasingly limited resources in ways that produce the best return for our students and for the Alaska public to whom we are responsible? What is the return on the investment in programs like the APS and the AEG and the loan programs? The things that we can easily measure, like the number of program participants or even the number of program completers, cannot answer the return on the public investment question. To answer the ROI question, we need to know the long-term outcomes of the programs across different public sectors, such as Alaska spends approximately $5 million annually on the Alaska Education Grant Program. Do recipients graduate at higher rates than non-recipients? Does the program help recipients enter the workforce sooner than similarly situated non-recipients? When they do enter the workforce, do they earn more? Or an earlier question we had was relative to loan forgiveness. Was it successful given the costs of forgiveness? And if we had a cross-sector outcomes database back at the time of loan forgiveness, we could know, did students who took forgivable loans complete their degrees and return to Alaska at rates higher than other students? Did they work in Alaska? Did they stay in Alaska at rates higher than others? In other words, are we spending public money in smart ways that make the most difference for students and for the Alaska economy? The challenging part of answering questions like this is not that we don't have the data. We do have it. The challenge is that the data is currently housed in separate transactional databases. Each time we have a question like this about long-term outcomes, agencies have to put together a data sharing MOU, extract the relevant data from our various systems, match it, link it, and then get the answers to the questions. And in accordance with federal privacy law, once we have those answers, we then have to destroy the linked data to protect individual privacy, which means that if there's a follow-up question, the process has to start again. This process can be inefficient and expensive, and it can also result in the need to have duplicate identifiable citizen data. HB 221 streamlines this process by allowing the Department of Labor to share unit-level employment and wage records with the outcomes database, which is maintained by ACPE. This database securely houses de-identified linked statistics from ACPE, the University of Alaska, the Department of Education and Early Development, and from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, but right now only training and GED data from labor. With HB 221, it would also house the employment and wage record statistics. Once data is linked, personally identifiable information, or PII, is stripped off, and PII is never stored with the resulting big picture statistics. What this outcome database offers us is a faster, more cost-efficient way to do longitudinal outcomes assessments, and a key part of doing this is minimizing the proliferation of personally identifiable data, PII. Also, it allows us to retain the de-identified link statistics so we can respond to follow-up questions or efficiently perform future analyses. Without this outcomes database, we will continue to need the duplicative and less efficient process described earlier. As previously noted, Alaska currently spends more than $2 billion annually on our K-12, post-secondary, and workforce training, but we don't currently have a system to provide efficient and cost-effective and secure statistics to the legislature and the administration on the value received from those public investments. HB 221 enhances Alaska's ability to provide that feedback in several ways. Number one, it allows the Department of Labor to provide unit-level employment and wage data for longitudinal analysis, something 28 other states already do. It prohibits the sharing of the unit-level data from the outcomes database with the federal government, and it codifies that data in the database must be de-identified and sets out what that means, and it clarifies ACPE's authority to maintain longitudinal statistics. HB 221 does not commit any funding for these programs. It just allows for the inclusion of the additional statistics in the outcomes longitudinal database, which was created a few years ago under a federal grant. Specific to funding, you'll note that the bill has a zero fiscal note. The outcomes database was created already to accept the workforce data, so there's no new cost there. Longer term, it's our intent to seek resources, potentially through another federal grant, to provide expanded outcomes reports once these additional statistics are available in the outcomes database. In this time of such severely constrained resources, we believe there is significant opportunity to attract grant dollars to this project, recognizing that tough budget times make it even more important that policymakers be able to access cross-sector statistics needed to evaluate program outcomes. I'd also like to be very clear for the record that we do not anticipate that we'll be able to produce all of these reports and outcomes analyses immediately upon passage of HB 221, since we would need funding to use the data and to do those analyses. However, HB 221 would get us a step closer, and a very important step closer, without additional cost to being able to provide you with those kinds of outcome analyses as we seek other funds. In summary, the long-term goal is to have the ability to quickly and easily and inexpensively
produce reports like the APS Outcomes Report to look at the outcomes of other programs, K-12 programs, as well as collegiate and career training programs, and provide you with information to know not just how much the program costs, but what the return is on that cost investment. Thank you for the opportunity to present this information. I hope it's been useful, and I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Thank you. We've got a question from Representative Guerra, and also, did you want Ms. Carrie Thomas to come up as well, or?
If there are technical questions, I may need assistance from Ms. Thomas.
Great. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Director Butler, I think the bill is a good idea, so thank you, Representative Drummond. I think I basically have enough energy to do this job for like 2 more years. So this data is going to come in after I'm gone, and I just want to make sure it's not misused. So here are a couple concerns I have. Folks from broken homes tend to get financial aid or needs-based loans. Folks from broken homes tend, on average, not to – I think there's some evidence out there that folks who come from a family that has a college education tend to do better in college than those who are a first-generation college attender, might be somebody from broken home. So I don't know that – so it may be that your evidence shows that somebody who gets needs-based financial aid or a needs-based loan is not graduating at the same level as somebody who doesn't need any of that money. And I would hate for the statistics to be used in a way where – it's determined that we shouldn't help students who don't have resources because they're not doing as well as those who come from traditionally college-bound homes. So that's a concern I have.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, thank you for raising that important concern. When we're doing statistical analysis, one of the very key pieces is that we're comparing apples to apples, for want of a better term. So if we're looking at the outcomes for high-need students, we need to compare them to other high-need students who didn't participate in that program to evaluate the program. We need to be very careful not to compare high-need students with non-high-need students.
Through the chair. And then just thank you. I appreciate that. And then in the same vein, somebody may decide to go to college to become a writer or to do art, and their wage is very likely going to be less than somebody who chooses to become, let's say their dream is to become a laborer, right? So you had mentioned that you're going to take a look at time to work and wages, and it might be there's a value of getting an art degree or a communications degree that has nothing to do with money and wages, right? So I want to make sure that data is, if that data comes in 3 years from now and I'm gone in 2 years, I want to make sure that data is not misused.
So. Through the chair, Representative Guerra, what we anticipate doing is comparing groups at fairly high levels. It's going to be, as Representative Drummond noted, a bird's eye view. So we'll be looking at college graduates compared to other college graduates. The more granular we get, if we're looking at the major level, we're able to give information that certain majors may earn more after completion of graduation than other majors. But it's really difficult not to consider those other questions, such as this was a personal choice.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This past weekend, I spent some time talking to a lot of people up in my district in Fairbanks, not on the college side, on the labor, carpenters, all of these type of jobs. I'm curious as to how many high school graduates in the state of Alaska actually complete college compared to how many people graduate from an apprenticeship program or a technical school, and the wage comparison in those two are usually very surprising, that a young person can go to a technical school or technical college or technical side of things or apprenticeship program and make a lot more money. So my curiosity is, how do we encourage those people to go to those programs? The Carpenters Union is begging for people to go to their apprenticeship program because they're going to be building 200 to 600 houses in Fairbanks in the next year to two. They can't find any kids that want to become carpenters. How do we encourage those kids to become into those programs?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, that's a great question that the database would actually help us answer. One of the pieces of feedback we got from a counselor, it was relative specific to mining, but a very similar question was, when I'm counseling students, one of the things I want to be able to tell them is, if you go into, in this case it was mining, you'll be able to earn this much money this far down the line versus another program. And we don't have those statistics right now specific for Alaskans. So the goal of this database would be able to provide counselors and teachers with tools like that.
I'll have more questions later. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Wilson, and then Kawasaki, and then Guttenberg. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what happened to the Answers program? I mean, my understanding when I was on the ACPE board that they were supposed to do exactly what you're explaining now with the $4 million that was given back in 2012.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, thank you for the question. Yes, there was a 2012 grant that was used to create the Answers program. There was not additional funding beyond that, so the Answers program did not take off. This database was actually created under that program.
Follow-up? So how will this be different than what was anticipated being with the Answers program?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the Answers program was a much broader scope proposal that would have included research and analysis. It would have included databases. It would have included online databases where there would be dashboards and informational products available to parents. This is a much smaller scope database.
I follow up, Mr. Chairman. And so now we're talking about not just children, but we're talking about adults. Who might be getting unemployment, from my understanding, or in other programs with the Department of Labor. Will there be like a box that someone checks that says, I'm, you know, okay that you use my data, or as soon as they go on to unemployment or take maybe a work program, is it automatically then put into the system?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there is not an opt-out box at this time. In order to have an opt-out box, we would have to actually identify individuals who wanted to opt out. And the primary premise behind this database is that the information is de-identified.
Follow-up? But if it was an opt-out box, their information wouldn't be in there, so it really wouldn't show up anywhere as an individual. Is that not correct?
To the chair, Representative Wilson, that is correct, but we would identify them for purposes of opt-out.
Okay, and a follow-up? And so you kind of somewhat answered my question on the fiscal note, too, when it talked about it's a zero fiscal note, but that's because this sounds like it's part one and you would need funding to actually utilize the data. This would just give permission to have the data. Do you have any information thus far of what potential funding would be necessary to actually utilize it?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we don't have exact figures to be able to give you. We have been encouraged to apply for a number of federal grants that would provide funding for us to begin to do some of the work to quantify that.
Follow-up? So just approximate. I mean, I know you don't know, but my concern is that we spent $4 million to do a program that there was a lot of question at that time whether or not we should start it because it was going to take additional funding. So do you have, I mean, if you're going to go for grants, is there like a target amount that you think that you'll need yearly to put this into figures and stats?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we have done some preliminary work, and unfortunately I can't quote you those amounts off the top of my head, but I'd be happy to do that research and bring it back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That would be very helpful.
Thank you. Great. Thanks, Representative Kawasaki.
Oh, thanks. And this is just for whoever can answer. I appreciate that the commission will be removing the personally identifiable information. I guess my question has to do with the information that you will receive. And what is all the information that you will be receiving from the unemployment insurance, from Department of Labor?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, thank you for the question. It will be information on wage records in order to identify through the unemployment database, the amount that is being earned in various categories.
And then follow up. And then, so And so in addition to the information that you'd get is the first, middle, last, Social Security, student ID number, address, and mailing address. The only other additional information that would be received from Department of Labor would be the wage and hour information. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, that is correct.
And I have another question.
Representative Kawasaki.
And is there a reason why, I guess there is, is there a reason why that information is necessary? Is there a reason why you need all this information up front, or is it something that can be, I just wanted to reduce the number of people's hands that have personal information, and so I'm trying to figure this thing out.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the outcomes database would actually reduce the number of times that information has to be touched and passed around. As things stand today, if we want to do any kinds of research relative to workforce outcomes, the information has to be extracted from various systems and matched, and at that time it is personally identifiable. So one of the goals would be to have a long-term database that is free from personally identifiable information and to reduce the risk of the proliferation of personally identifiable information. I'd also note that there are a number of reports that we produce now. The APS Outcomes Report is an example. That we would be able to produce in future years should this bill pass at this time, much less expensively and without having to link personally identifiable information.
Super. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I am a retired laborer. That's a skill I did all my life, and if you don't think it is, I'll take you to the field. And I've always been amazed that the number of people that cannot pass a textbook math question can do complex, practical field work. It always amazes me. So you've got post-secondary education, the University of Alaska, Department of Ed, and you're going to be merging databases. So my question becomes, how much of it is mergeable? Right now, you have, I mean, this goes back to old days for me, merging databases is really problematic if not everybody is aligned. And that could be a huge fiscal cost. So is that what you're looking for outside funds or grants? Or, I mean, how theoretically tomorrow you could be starting to analyze this as soon as this happened, but I imagine as quite a bit of technical stuff to merge what needs to be done. And what are we looking at as far as that goes?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, great question. Thank you. Two-part answer. Number one, we are linking only select elements from each of the data systems, only those elements that would be relevant to measuring outcomes. Number two is relative to the grant that Representative Wilson referred to. That work was done under that grant, and so all of that behind-the-scenes work to make those databases talk appropriately has already been accomplished. So what we would be seeking grant for in the future would be actually to do the research and analysis to use that data to develop the statistics that would provide outcomes information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm always amazed when we're looking for answers and we can't get them, and there's things like this, there's no way of doing those analysis to show us those things. And I'm always amazed when this stuff comes up and it's like, well, why haven't we been doing this? Because we're looking for statistical analysis of why things work or why they don't work, certainly with our students. But thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions of the committee? Seeing none, let's move over to public testimony. Public testimony on HB 221 is now open. And for folks who might want to email their public testimony, they can do so by sending that to housefinance@akleg.gov. Again, that's housefinance@akleg.gov. I don't believe there's anybody here in the room who would like to testify. We do have somebody online, somebody from that wonderful little town called Nome, Doug Walrath, if you're there. If you could put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, members of the House Finance Committee. My name is Doug Walrath. I'm the director of the Northwestern Alaska Career and Technical Center in Nome. also known as NACTEC. NACTEC is a regional training center with a primary student population served from the 15 villages of Bering Strait School District surrounding Nome, as well as Nome Public Schools as well. I'd like to take this opportunity to testify with regard to administering a statewide workforce and education-related statistics for program. As a regional training center, it is not uncommon to report on outcome measures with placement into employment 7 to 12 months following training. For programs serving primarily high school students, such measures neglect to account for the impact of training on keeping students engaged and in school. 75% to 80% of our high school training population are students enrolled in the 9th, 10th, and 11th grade. Employment measures 7 to 12 months after training can unintentionally disregard three-quarters of a training population and present a skewed view of success of training. Across rural Alaska, dropout rates tend to track disproportionately higher, just as graduation rates tend to track lower. A measure of persistence would shed light on the value of programs that are keeping students engaged and on the path to graduation. House Bill 221 presents a tool for measurement purposes through the K-12 years, tracking to post-secondary and thereafter employment. This would be of value to determine how a coherent sequence of vocational courses can begin at a junior high career exploration level, leading to certificated career immersion courses in the 12th grade, leading directly into employment or as a linkage to post-secondary continuation. Here at NACTEC, we would find value in longitudinal measures that House Bill 221 would present the opportunity to capture. For the purpose of student protection, a tool that protects personally identifiable information while utilizing aggregate comparisons would be of value. House Bill 221 proposes to do this and could provide outcome measures of enhanced value over some currently applied outcome measures. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Walrath. We have a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Doug, for what you do. Don't you keep certain statistics as far as those who go through your program? I'm just curious, you know, is there any specific information that you use, or is it just about how long the students stay in school in each one of the areas?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we do for the purposes of our programming, we want to know which students, for example, that may go through a healthcare strand, continue on to work in that field, but with a extremely small staff that we are and turning over lots of training programs, it's very difficult to impossible to be able to follow up on all former trainees and one, just know exactly where they're at. So this would certainly provide a tool to be able to extend well beyond our capability of doing so.
Thank you, and thanks again for what you do.
Thank you.
We have any questions for Mr. Walrath? Seeing no further questions, thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else online who would like to testify? And it doesn't look like it. So with that, we will go ahead and close public testimony on HB 221. And are there any other questions for the sponsor of the bill, Representative Wilson?
Yeah, just one question. Do we know what information unions use? I know they follow their students anywhere, I think, from a couple years. But do they use all the same type of information you have that Representative Kawasaki was talking about for the statistics that they utilize from within each union?
Ms. Butler.
Thank you to the Chair, Representative Wilson. Generally, I know that they do tracking, but I don't know what specific elements they're looking at. Be happy to do some research and bring that back to you.
I'd appreciate that because for years, we've always gotten those kind of statistics through the Department of Labor. And we will, and I know that's what kind of started the Answers Program, and to try to follow it is how do we do the same thing that they are able to do. So I just, I'd be curious whether or not they need, like, home addresses and all this other, or what data do they actually pull to be able to show the success of their apprenticeships. And maybe we could also find out what the issues they may be having finding students to do the apprenticeships, because you're talking about good-paying jobs, and be sad if we can't find Alaskans to fill them. Thank you.
Any further questions, Representative Seaton?
Thank you. Appreciate this. I really appreciate in the packet the Alaska Performance Scholarship Report because it gives us an idea of how this could all be done and be very helpful in identifying programs that are effective for seeing the outcomes we want. The one question that's not clear with me is on page 3, starting on line 14, we have the commission shall remove all the personal identifiable information, et cetera, you know, name, first name, last name, middle name, Social Security, student ID number, residential address, mailing address, before placing the information in the database. So that's all really clear. But then under D, we're talking about in this section, unit record means information pertaining to an individual. So I'm trying to figure out, are we looking at key elements, you know, whether you took certain courses, graduated from high school, graduated from Alaska, middle school, those kind of things. And then, so there's going to be this unit data that is just a blank person with these characteristics, and that will be what goes forward, but it won't be so specific that it can be identified to a particular individual. Is that what unit data means, or does it mean something else?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Seaton. Unit data simply means data that refers to a specific individual.
So when we're trying to coordinate that, it doesn't have any of this information on it in C, doesn't have any names, addresses, any of that, numbers. So I guess I'm trying to figure out how unit data referring to an individual, but that individual is not an identifiable individual. I'm trying to figure out how we coordinate all those things.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. As we receive unit-level data, the PII will be stripped off. The remaining statistics that we wish to use will be assigned a random number, and the information will be moved into a separate database so that an individual's personally identifiable information is never stored in the same database as the statistics that we'll be using for outcomes reporting.
Thank you. So we've got a question from Representative Guttenberg.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Along the lines of the same thing Representative Seaton talked about, so we're taking all that information out, we're giving them a new identifiable number. When new data comes in, and maybe this is just too technical an answer now, because it's how are you going to identify somebody coming in? Is it going to just merge within its existing? When it comes out, it's just only that identifying number. So inside of the system, it can merge together, but outside it has a different number.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, that is basically correct. And Mr. Chair, if you would like to have a much more articulate description of how that process works than what I can do, Ms. Thomas is available to walk through exactly how that works.
If it's more than that, I mean, that kind of explains it to me, but if that's fine.
Sounds like he's okay with that, so thank you very much.
Yeah.
Any follow-ups, Representative Guttenberg?
No, that's good.
Any further questions? Seeing no further questions.
Mr. Chair, unless there's any objection, I'd like to move House Bill 221, Version A, out of committee with individual recommendations.
Object.
And we objection, Representative Wilson.
So we're going to move this bill we're currently talking about. I'm sorry, I was looking at the next one. Because I have an amendment for the bill that we have before us.
Okay, there is an amendment. Do you have it prepared, or do you need a, or
well,
is
no,
it in concept?
This is the first time I remember hearing it, so okay. No, I usually listen to it first.
Okay, so. If it was going to be the will of the committee and there were no amendments today, then we have that option. But we also do have a bill deadline set, so that's also the other avenue. And that bill deadline, by the way, will be Wednesday at 5 p.m. Into my office April 4th.
If I can get the amendment sooner, I'll let you know, because I have no problem hearing it sooner than that. And I'm concerned about the opt-in, opt-out portion of it, because we're talking about adults now, not just children, information and how something like that would look like.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. So with that, I believe there is a motion on the table, but Representative Garrow, if you wouldn't mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I withdraw my motion to move the bill, and we'll wait for the amendments.
Thank you, Representative Garrow. Are there any further questions on the bill? Seeing no further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And so we'll set HB 221 aside, and the amendment deadline has been announced. And let's move on to our last bill today, and that is HB 400, and that is fees for fire prevention measures by the House State Affairs Committee. And if it is will of the committee, we would like to move this bill today. And I believe we have Representative Christ Tompkins here to present the bill as the chair of House State Affairs, Representative Chris Tompkins, and his aide, Kathy. You might have to say your last name for me here. And just a reminder, we have, I believe, heard this bill, and so we are looking at possibly moving that today if it is will of the committee, HB 400. With that, if you could both put yourselves on the record.
Thank you. For the record, Jonathan Christ Tompkins, Representative of District 35, Southeast Islands and Small Communities.
Kathy Schlingheit, staff to Representative Christ Tompkins.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, for the opportunity to present HB 400. It's a one-page bill. It has a simple story. That story is the House Finance Subcommittee that was under the auspices of the Community and Regional Affairs Committee that I was sitting in on. There was a statutory change recommendation made in that process trying to help the department streamline its operations, operate more efficiently, and cut down on UGF and either replace it with user fees or, in this case, DGF. This was an opportunity in which the State Fire Marshal's Office identified such an opportunity. The Finance Subcommittee unanimously agreed that that was an idea that merited exploration. We volunteered to take up the cause. We drafted a committee bill. It moved through State Affairs in four hearings. Part of the reason for that more extended consideration was the State Fire Marshal's Office had a few other ideas they wanted to explore. We considered that through a couple of amendments that were entertained by the committee but ultimately rejected. So the committee was discharged in the same form that it was received in, which is the one-page version that you're looking at right now. And now it is before you all in the House Finance Committee, the second and final committee referral.
Okay, great. And I also want to mention that we have Chief David Tyler, Division of Fire and Life Safety from the Department of Public Safety, available for questions online. So with that, do we have any questions for the sponsor, Representative Wilson, and then Thompson?
The sad thing is I can't find it right now, but I thought I read where we were doing certain inspections. They weren't getting around to – oh, I'm sorry. I got it. So on the fiscal note, on page 2, when they're talking about fire inspections, and it might be the person who's on the phone, but it says $50 per hour with a one-hour minimum. Anticipates the average inspection to take 2 hours. The goal is to accomplish 1,500 inspections per year, but currently 500 is more likely. So I guess I'm trying to figure out what happens to the other 1,000 while they're waiting to have the inspection done. Do they just pay a fee and have no inspection? Or are we talking like if you're on the road system, you're more likely to get inspected versus if you're not on the road system? I'm just trying to understand that particular part of the fiscal note.
Representative Christ Hopkins?
I might defer to the State Fire Marshal if that is, in fact, or the Admin Services Director for DPS, either or, who wrote the fiscal note.
I can answer the question I'm good with.
Mr. Tyler, if you're there, if you could put yourself on the record.
Yes, sir. My name is David Tyler. I'm the State Fire Marshal. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you just fine.
Oh, excellent. Yes, the $50 per hour was the number that was put together just to give an idea of what could potentially happen. I don't know that that's where we'd end up going. I think we'd probably be going more towards like if it's an assembly-type occupancy under 2,000 square feet, it would be one amount. If it was between 2,000 and 5,000 square feet, it would be another amount, simply because the different inspectors would inspect at a different rate, and that way we're charging a more equitable amount. And as far as the people in the road system, the business in the road system get inspected more frequently, that's absolutely correct. They do now because they're easier to get to. We can't afford to get to the other ones. And with increased funding, we'd have the ability to hit some of these other communities so that it is more equitable across the state.
So, follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Teller. So what I'm trying to figure out, though, is, and sadly enough, I know in the road system you get hit harder. So when someone needs a permit right now and they're not on the road system, I mean, obviously you can't inspect them and charge them the $50 per hour. How do you handle that now?
Well, right now, through the chair, Representative Wilson, right now they're just not being inspected. And they would, under this bill, they would not be charged a fee unless they were inspected.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
So could you give me, because I can tell that each one of these get a little bit more expensive. There's probably more intense to do. So could you tell me the type of places you're talking about that would fall underneath the $50 per hour that aren't being inspected right now? What type of places?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, hotels, lodges, large assembly areas, like auction houses, occupancies of that nature, and as well as the industrial type occupancies as well, oil and gas, in schools as well.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
So I don't know if this is a question to you or to the maker, so my concern is, and I'm behind the what we're trying to do in the bill, and I sit on that subcommittee, and we need more of the inspections because we don't want fire to happen. But how do we justify now that we're going to charge fees? The other three, it sounds like, and Mr. Tyler can correct me if I'm wrong, that they're able to keep up with the demand that's necessary for the fire system technician permits, the fire extinguisher technician permits, and then I guess those are the two main ones. But how can we justify charging a hotel that's in Fairbanks, but not a hotel that, not to pick on Nome, but since I'm from Fairbanks and he's from Nome, they don't get the charge because they can't get out there, but yet we're not going to charge it because somebody happens to be on the road system, where before we weren't doing any charging at all. So how do we justify that to the businesses?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, with the revenue generated with the associated fees, we should be able to hit our goal of 1,500 inspections a year. And that would make it equitable across the state and give our rural communities the same opportunity to have safe structures as the more urban ones.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And so then if I understand it correctly, so the $50 an hour is once you get to whatever you're inspecting, travel and that, which is kind of by time, because some won't cost you hardly anything to get to, and others cost you more, and you'll be able, you're figuring the $50 an hour will give you enough to be able to do inspections, no matter where there are, but the majority of them.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't know if there's a way, if we were to charge the rural communities more because they're so far away, I don't know that would be affordable by doing a flat rate. And I'm not a big fan of doing it by the hour. I think a set occupancy, if you're a hotel under 30,000 square feet, it's going to cost you X number of dollars. If you're larger than that, it's going to cost more. That way it's predictable across the board. It doesn't matter if you're in Nome or if you're in Fairbanks that way.
And one other follow-up?
Follow-up.
And I don't want to charge the communities more either. I was just trying to figure out when the clock started, because if I have a repairman, sometimes it starts when they get to my house and sometimes it starts from when they, put the tools in their truck. But you're looking at, and you have enough ability to the way that the bill's written, that you could actually do it, like you're saying, by the square footage or what kind of whether it's a hotel or a restaurant, but you're looking more of utilizing that type versus a per hour.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct. I think that's much more fair way of doing this.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Thompson, and then Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I don't know. Let me see if I can turn this into a question. The city of Fairbanks is a home rule. We have our own building department. We have our own building codes, including fire. And we have our own fire department that does inspections also. So my question is, are we layering things here to charge people more? Because we got a pretty hefty building permit fee at the present time. Our fire department goes in and really does look at anybody's building plans and certifies it or doesn't. They work together on this. Other questions here that I'm looking to try to figure out how to ask is fire extinguisher and fire system permitting and programs. We have professional companies that are certified in Fairbanks that go around and certify and update the fire extinguishers and fire extinguisher systems in kitchens or in buildings, in commercial buildings. And then our fire department goes around and always checks every one of those every year to make sure their fire extinguishers are up to date with their certifications and everything. So I'm just kind of curious, are we putting in here another layer that can be charged to a company or to a business inside of a city that's a home rule city that has their own codes and their own departments? That's the question, I guess.
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, thanks for the question. That is not what would happen. The city of Fairbanks is a deferred jurisdiction. We have deferred our authority to them, and they do all that work instead of us, as does the city of Juneau, Anchorage. There's several of them that are doing their own. The university campus is a deferred jurisdiction. And in fact, as a side note, that's one of my goals, is to get any community that has matured to the point where they can do this themselves to let them do it, because a local community can do it much better than I can. But as far as the permitting goes, the companies that come out and to do the inspections, we permit them, we certify them to do those checks, and that's what this is for. It's not us going and doing the work for them. We're just giving them the authority to do it.
Thank you very much. That clarified a lot and makes me feel a little bit more comfortable about where we're headed with this. Thank you.
Hey, Representative Kawasaki, and then Guttenberg, and then Tilton. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for being here, Mr. Fire Marshal. I did have a question, and I just wanted to put it on record because we did discuss this during the subcommittee process. But in places where or in facilities like nonprofits, places where there's children, those types of facilities, churches, you would want the ability to be able to waive the associated fee. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I believe the bill is worded so we could do that as well. Yes, sir.
Great. I think it just needed to be on record that it's not suddenly going to be a huge charge for facilities that can't afford it, and that the director will have the ability to waive those fees, specifically because it's an important feature of fire and life safety that these inspections happen, but not that they're so detrimental to cost that they just don't have them, that they're not being done. So I just wanted to thank you again, Mr. Tyler.
Thank you.
And Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave, I appreciate the bill, and I don't believe we should simply be doing inspections because it's something we can charge for. I think fire safety inspections are important, though. But is there a statistical analysis on what we're going to prevent happening by inspecting more places? I mean, in Alaska, it's hard to, especially when you get off the road system, there's a lot of old places that don't conform to anything. But is there an analysis of what the expectation is on the fires that we're going to prevent from happening just because we have inspections and that we're checking code?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, thank you. That's a great question. I have some information, some data on some school fires. From 2001 through 2007, we had 76 uncontained fires in public schools with a total dollar loss in excess of $50 million. That included Hooper Bay and as well as Talkeetna schools, which were total losses. In FY08, we requested and received a $105,000 increment to help get these inspections back up current. From 2008 to 2012, we had 47 uncontained fires in the schools with a total loss of $1.4 million. Since then, through staffing issues, which we don't have right now, and through reductions in travel funding, since 2013, we're up to $7 million again. The inspections make a difference in only the things that we can find, the dangers that we can eliminate, the hazards that we can eliminate. But there's also an education component when we're out working with these folks, and that helps carry them, you know, through hopefully the next session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Tyler, on the fire systems technician's permit and the extinguisher technician permit, it's a three-year permit period. When you do the fire inspections, is that only initial inspections on the building, or are they required on an annual basis? Or
through the chair, Representative Tilton, our goal right now is to do inspections every 2 years. That'd be about 1,500 a year. In a perfect world, the industry standard is every year, and that's not realistic in our situation in most cases, and especially now with the funding levels that we have. So our goal is to hit it every 2 years and make our difference that way.
Follow-up? Yes, and can you tell me how many inspections? You have your goal of 1,500, but currently 500 is more likely. Can you tell me how many you did last year?
I got the numbers here. I believe it was 213. We were down to three deputies. We were short two deputy fire marshals, which we have since hired, and I expect it will be closer to 500 right now this current fiscal year, because we're moving them up pretty good.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
So can you estimate how many inspections, how many buildings there are out there that should be inspected, not considering new construction, because obviously we don't know what that's going to be?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Tilton, we have a little better than 3,000 structures that we are responsible by statute to inspect.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Wilson?
I just want to make sure, Mr. Chairman, we put this on record. So these are not new regulations. These are ones that are already in existence. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the statute requirements to do this is existing. That's correct.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Any further questions, the committee? Seeing none, let's open this up to public testimony for HB 400. And if folks would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at housefinance@akleg.gov. And so is there anybody in the room who would like to testify on this? I don't see anybody. Is there anybody online who would like to testify? Looks like nobody. So we will go ahead and close public testimony on HB 400. Again, if folks would like to email us, they can do so by sending in written testimony to housefinance@akleg.gov. And so with that, what is the will of the committee? Are we correct? Yep. If we are ready to move this, then I would ask that Representative Guerra read the fiscal note into the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 400 has a zero fiscal note, which is really an indeterminate one. Department of Public Safety, Fire, Life, and Safety, OMB Component 3051. Zero fiscal note. The estimate is that it will raise about $84,000 in designated general funds through fees.
Do you have any questions on the fiscal note? Representative Wilson?
I just want to add to this. Really isn't, for me, it's not just about the fees, but it's the amount of money that we ended up putting out a few years ago because we weren't able to do these inspections. And as Mr. Tyler said, schools unfortunately burned down, and we ended up paying millions and millions of dollars when maybe just being able to afford to go out and check more of these out, we wouldn't have that happen. So hopefully we'll be able to get to more places and not have those things happen.
Thank you. If there are no further questions, I'd entertain a motion. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 400, version 30, LS1490/A from House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
I don't see any objections. So with that, House Bill 400, version 30-LS1490/A is reported out from House Finance with individual recommendations, the attached fiscal note. And so is there anything else to come before the committee? I don't see any.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Christ-Tompkins. Yeah. So our next meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, April 3rd at 10 a.m., and at that meeting we will hear HB 197, Community Seed Libraries, HB 299, Extend the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, HB 41, Joint Prime Sponsorship of Bills. And with that, we will be adjourned at 4:40 p.m. Thank you.